Hello, and welcome to episode 26 of the Poisons and Pestilence podcast. Mustard and the Fascist Way of War with Charles Stevenson. Today, we're very lucky to be joined by Charles Stevenson, who has kindly agreed to come and speak to us. Charles Stevenson is a prolific historical author. I've been going through some of his back catalogue over the past couple of days, and I've noticed he's in a couple of books, actually, which relate to chemical warfare, so I was very happy when he agreed to come on the show. So, Charles, welcome. Very nice for you to come on. Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about how you got into history, and then more specifically, how you've ended up doing a couple of books on the history of chemical warfare.
Well, I got into history because I'm a former offshore oil rig worker, oil and gas industry, which gives you a lot of free time. And after a couple of years of burning it all off down the pub, I decided to take a university degree in my spare time, which I did. Then I thought to myself, What do you do with a history degree? Well, you write history. So I started obviously picking subjects that interested me for whatever reason, and chemical warfare was one of them. I can't tell you why exactly, but I've long had an interest in the subject, and so I decided to write about it.
And so, as I understand it, you did a book a few years ago, which I'm still working through, on the Napoleonic era.
Well, Lord Dundonald, the name kept coming up as in histories of chemical warfare, and I didn't know who Lord Dundonald was, so did a bit of research into him, and he was Thomas Cochrane, the famous buccaneering seaman of the time. He discovered, if you like, the fumes of sulphur from the Sicilian sulphur industry. He discovered that they were toxic, poisonous. I think, as he said himself, to the imperial mind, it suggested use in warfare for attacking stone masonry fortifications. If you could make the very atmosphere toxic, then the people defending them wouldn't be able to. That was his basic thesis.
And it's interesting because that, I think I'd read a book on the US Civil War around the same sort of era, where there was certainly some work on these things. And I guess for me, I found the book interesting because you're talking about a period of the development of chemical warfare, which is often snipped out of the history books in a sense, because very often it's as if chemical warfare emerges out of nowhere in 1916.
I think it's Prentice makes the point that during the American Civil War, one of the reasons that chemical warfare didn't develop was because of the very, very undeveloped state of the American chemical industry at that time.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. I think it's interesting, isn't it, that if you look at some of the, I think in the US, there's a lot of old patents that are there. They look quite similar to what actually would eventually emerge sort of 40, 50 years later. But as you say, at the time, it just wasn't economically viable. It wasn't the time for these things.
No, and if you've read about Fritz Haber, the Germans had a massive chemical industry, lots of chemicals and nothing to do with them. They couldn't do anything with them. It was one of the factors in turning them towards chemical warfare.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting book of history. So I can't wait to go back through that book, which I thought we just mentioned before we start, because it was one of those things where I found it. I'd been hoping it'd been written somewhere and you had written it. So that was absolutely brilliant. But today we're going to be talking about another point in the history, which in the kind of larger histories of chemical warfare tends to get given reasonably short shrift. It's alluded to often in relation to the other example of the Rif War with the Spanish, with the use of airily delivered chemical weapons. So today we're going to be talking about the invasion of Ethiopia, 1935 to 1936. So why don't you tell us a little bit about how you stumbled into that topic?
Well, I'd written a previous book about Italian colonialism, the Italo-Ottoman War, when the Italians basically tried to take Libya, what became Libya, as it were. And as you say, there's very, very little in English anyway, quite a lot in Italian, but very little in English on that particular conflict.
And the Libyan conflict, I've seen the occasional allusion to the idea that at least at a small scale, chemical weapons may have been used in that Libyan conflict that came before it in 1930. Did you bump into that as part of the studies for that book?
Yeah, well, when the Italians had to reconquer, as it were, the Libyan colony, they did utilise chemical weapons on a fairly small scale, because obviously it was more or less a guerrilla war rather than a conventional war. But they did use chemical weapons, and perhaps they got that idea from the Spanish, in what was then Spanish Morocco. Perhaps, I didn't actually research that. But when they came to prepare for the conquest of Ethiopia, they developed a new chemical munition specifically for that job, rather than use the sort of conventional stuff they'd been using before. They developed that C-500T mustard gas bomb.
It's interesting. Let's talk a little bit about the context of that. So at the end of the First World War, as I understand it, there's this weird situation where on the one hand you have drives within some aspects of government and international level to prohibit chemical warfare, or at least to place stronger limits on its use, and to, you see, the Geneva Conventions on gas warfare and these sorts of things emerging. But at the same time, you also have a lot of advocacy within many states for the further exploration of chemical warfare, for the necessity of stockpiles. And while some chemical warfare services seem to be sort of fighting this idea that chemical warfare was a thing of the trenches and will never be needed again, what wins out, of course, is the idea that there's actually great potentials, militarily speaking, in these weapons. And so you do still see continued and expanded militarization. In the Italian case, then, it's interesting you're saying that they obviously had First World War experience, but they seemingly proactively sought to develop this weapon. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about that munition?
It's the C was for chemical. The 500 came from the fact that it was the same physical dimensions as the 500 kilogram high explosive bomb, and the T was for a timed fuse. And when the invasion of Ethiopia was first mooted, one of the proposals was to spray mustard gas from aircraft, which was a technique that was certainly a feasible technique, but they decided that it was probably far too dangerous for the aircrew and the people who'd have to maintain the planes to do that. So they developed this munition, the same dimension, so it would fit onto standard aircraft or onto their existing aircraft, same dimensions as a 500 kilogram bomb, but it contained 215 kilograms of iprite, as they call it in Italian.
Yeah, so this period is the height of concern about the new potentials of air power. And so there are many areas of rapid advance in strategy, in munitions, in aircraft. Looking at the history of the British program, we had spray tanks that were developed, but as you know, you spraying mustard out the back of a plane, that plane is, you don't want to, you know, if that's your plane, it's not ideal, is it? So I mean, there's a strong resistance for that within the air services, as you might imagine. This then, I guess, brings us to this idea. This weapon was developed specifically with this conflict in mind, it seems like. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about what was happening and why Italy, in the middle of the 1930s, is considering an illegal invasion of Ethiopia.
Largely because of revenge for their earlier 19th century defeat at Adwa. A small Italian force was routed and massacred. National humiliation there. And of course, Mussolini wanted to do great things. He wanted revenge for that. Italy was also, or fascism perhaps, the fascist regime was in difficulties in the mid-30s, economic problems, as was most of the rest of the world. And this was a way out, a way of rallying the population in a patriotic endeavour. It was Mussolini's war, without doubt. I mean, he conceived it, he pushed it. there was very little to be gained economically. It was hardly a wealth, you know, it wasn't a diamonds, gold, oil, any other advantageous substances there. But it was the glory of Italy. It was a fascist goal. Fascism was bombastic, mock heroic. This was avenging a past deed or a past humiliation, and leading on to greater glory. That was the motivation. There were no high and mighty ideals. It was simply a fascist gambit, Mussolini's gambit.
And you know, in the book, I think, you know, quite commonly in the history of warfare, you see a revival of Italian nationalism, a rallying cry around this within Italy. So it certainly does no harm, in the short term at least, to his security within that state. Internationally, however, it's an odd one. And perhaps it speaks in part to why this conflict is so rarely spoken about, because this was the era of the League of Nations. In many ways, this is one of the earliest test cases for that organization. I think it's fair to say that it was an abject failure in terms of the international society and the extent to which they resisted and punished Italy for what was a blatant invasion of a sovereign state. So in your work, when you were reading around this, what came through for you about why and how states responded to this Italian act of aggression?
It parallels almost the early invasion of what became Libya by so-called liberal Italy, laid off two great power blocks against each other during that invasion. The Austro-Hungarian Germans and the Italians were an alliance. So if the Austrians or the Germans objected to Italy doing what they were doing, they would push them into the influence of the Entente, Britain, France and Russia. On the other hand, if Britain, France or Russia objected, they would more firmly cement their union with the Austrians and Germans, so they were able to wend their way down the middle. And much the same happened with Ethiopia. Britain and France wanted to detach Italy from the orbit of Germany. The Germans were hardly likely to object, and the Hitler regime was hardly likely to object. And if they had, they would have further pushed them towards France and Britain. So it was dropping through the cracks, if you like, in the alliance systems in the earlier conflict. Mussolini was thought to be, of course, useful for trying to contain Hitler.
One of the points that came up in the book, which I say surprised to see, but actually it's completely within keeping with real politics, but was the idea of the US trying to negotiate its position, and it was selling oil to both sides. And so there was a lot of pressure within the US saying, well, actually, we probably, you know, shouldn't be selling oil to the fascists that are invading. But the US decides, oh, no, we want to maintain partiality, so we'll just keep selling oil to both of them at the same scale, as if that somehow absolved them.
Well, of course, there's an awful lot of Italian Americans, you know, they're voters. And Roosevelt certainly, he was in his first term then, wasn't he? And he was a political calculating machine. He did not want to alienate Italian Americans, most of whom, apparently, so we're told, were pro-fascist. Whether that's true or not, I really wouldn't like to say.
So for various reasons then, this invasion went on. There was minimal pushback from states on this. The League of Nations, basically, you know, no one was taking it seriously at this point. I think it was quite tragic. You mentioned in the book that perhaps some aspects within Ethiopia had placed greater stock in normative and political pressure created by the League of Nations in preventing what they knew was going to be coming their way. And I think the other one is kind of shame. I think you pull that out when you were in the book talking about domestic politicians basically knowing, yes, this is you know, barbaric what's happening, and it's shameful all around. The interesting point, which I guess takes us through, I think, to some of the discussion of some of the strategies in the conflict more generally, was as that war develops, there were already aid agencies from the West, places like the Red Cross, on the ground. And these were witnessing firsthand this war unfolding. it's undeniable this was happening. It was in the press, it was in the media, and certainly in the Western memory, these scenes would be used as part of the stigmatization of the Italian fascists in the Second World War, because, of course, after all this, they still went and did their own thing anyway in the Second World War. Let's talk a little bit about the operational aspects and how that invasion played out and how they prepared, how the Italians prepared for it in a thought of the sort of conflict they expected to fight.
Well, they, as JFC Fuller and various other military theorists and commentators said, that they advanced in World War One style. Massive forces, huge. I think it was three army corps at the very beginning from the north, from Eritrea, advanced into, they called it a terrain like Switzerland, probably more like Afghanistan would be a comparison today. But what that meant, of course, was that they couldn't be beaten, couldn't be humiliated and defeated, as had happened some 35, 40 years earlier. But it was a very conventional, at first, operation. And, of course, there was a further front, the southern front from Somalia, with Graziani, who had a much smaller force and was initially supposed to stay on the defensive. But the two fronts never coordinated, or never coordinated to any great extent. And it was the northern front, Di Bono, who, as I say, advanced three army corps through incredibly hostile terrain, and I think I make the point in the book somewhere, they had to emulate their Roman ancestors in building their roads as they went, because Ethiopia was a dreadfully underdeveloped country. The roads, inverted commas, were no little more than tracks, so moving 100,000 men through that kind of terrain was a massive undertaking and inevitably ponderous.
So in those sort of situations, typically then, the question is, how do you want the enemy to engage with you? So the Italians, I guess, were they seeking to draw local forces into large-scale battles? Was that the kind of logic they were engaging with, do you think?
Well, their logic behind the invasion was invade with on a massive scale, such that it would be nearly impossible for them to suffer humiliation by being defeated by the Ethiopians, who really didn't have an army as it was recognised in the Western world. But it could mobilise an awful lot of men who were individually fierce fighters, but they weren't organised along divisions, corps and all the rest as a Western army would have been. If Haile Selassie, if he'd been able to command his forces, because he wasn't a dictator. Ethiopia had a very devolved government, if to put it in Western terms. If all these troops they mobilised had devolved into guerrilla warfare, the Italians would have had huge problems. They already did have huge problems. But what the Ethiopians tried to do was fight them conventionally. Basically, the Italians dug in and waited for the Ethiopians to attack them, where they were massacred virtually. Artillery, machine guns, aircraft, against light infantry. They had aerial supremacy. Yeah. There was no Ethiopian air force. There was, but we're talking 10 planes, none of them fit for combat.
So the Italians felt relatively safe within their compounds, as it were, but then they still had the problem of roving attacks on supply lines and those types of things. And so at this point, then it became clear, if they weren't careful, going to find themselves continuing to get ground up while trying to occupy that country. So why don't you talk to me through, I thought what you did a really good job in the book was going through the first early uses of chemical weapons in that conflict and how that came about and some of the considerations, both back in capital, but also in field in relation to the strategies and tactics of use. So when did mustard start making an appearance, and how was it used?
Mustard is a very difficult weapon to use, because where you use it, your own forces then cannot pass, occupy the territory. It was used in a more an operational sense to block passes, and a retreating enemy as well, used massively on retreating enemies. And it's used for blocking river crossings and so on and so forth. Supposedly, the first use was in retaliation for the murder of two Italian airmen, but it was actually used several days before. The Italians had meant to use it from the very beginning. They developed that munition in order to utilize it, and it was used to, as I say, to block off. It was used strategically to block paths for the Ethiopians, a path through the mountains, passages through the mountains, across rivers, and so on, and on villages, and of course it contaminates ground, and the Ethiopians depended largely on cattle and so on. They will eat the grass, they will die. It was a pretty horrible way of making water. I mean, civilians as much as enemy troops were victims.
So one thing that came out for me reading the book was there seems to have been, I don't know if you saw it this way, but there seems to have been a potential moment where chemical weapons could have been part of a moral crisis which did impact or feed back on US or Western policy, and that was the targeting of a aid station which was marked as Red Cross and had international Red Cross agency staff there. So why don't we talk a little bit about that first major attack on the hospital?
It cannot be a coincidence that so many attacks were made on Red Cross facilities. The Italians, of course, thought, rightly or wrongly, that the Ethiopians were using them and were hiding behind the Red Cross. They certainly made a habit of attacking Red Cross facilities.
And I think in one of the earlier attacks, which made it into the international press at the time, the description of that attack, which I think involved, well, there was a few attacks, easily confused, but at least one, there was at least three waves of attack in which incendiaries and explosives and mustard were used. Reading that, you know, that's the one where if there was going to be a switch or a change in policy, a willingness to do that, that would have been the moment. But seemingly the US were very hesitant to make a big thing out of this.
That was the American hospital at Dessie, yes. You know, real politicking. There's the bombing of a Red Cross facility in a faraway, you know, the Horn of Africa. How much would that impact on domestic politics in America, for example? You know, probably not a lot.
And what I thought was also interesting is because the materials which we found in Italian, and again, I credit to the work because these materials were not, I didn't know about them and certainly don't appear in many of the Western histories at all. You actually get the perspectives of pilots and from their biographies and how they saw and how they felt about the use of chemical weapons against the Ethiopian people.
I don't think any moral question arose. The Ethiopians to the Italians were savages. I mean, some of the race laws that were later introduced into what became Italian East Africa were some of the most discriminatory that ever existed. Incredibly so. I mean, and this despite the fact that it was African troops, Eritreans and Somalis, who spearheaded the Italian advance, and arguably, without them, they wouldn't have succeeded.
And of course, you know, in terms of the impacts, because of the presence of Red Cross, we have numerous forms of documentary evidence of the injuries caused by the mustard, particularly lower legs from walking through areas that have been contaminated, as well as fatalities. In terms of how it progressed, the use is massive. I mean, and I think I read somewhere that at some point up to a third of shells they were using, or maybe you can correct me on that figure, ended up being chemical, because they seemed to do something that actually would appear in Western doctrine later on, at least hypothetical doctrine of use, of combining conventional incendiary and chemical munitions when attacking civilian areas. Is that right?
Well, they did use, I think it was Pedriali, the aviation historian, who said this was the only war Italy was ever involved in where a truly American style of in terms of the lavish provision of munitions and so on and so forth, appeared. So, yeah, I mean, Italy put everything into conquering Ethiopia. I do provide some other figures. They spent the military budget up to about 1938. In 1935, just on conquering this one African nation. It's probably not the case that it made any decisive difference. I don't think. Few people would argue, I think, that Ethiopia was conquered, you know, specifically by the use of chemical weapons. They certainly assisted the Italians, but it was air power mainly and mechanization, motorization, which were the key factors.
And another thing that was interesting for me reading, you start your book with a more contemporary discussion about the memorialization of this conflict, and in particular the extent to which part of the reason we don't have many histories in English, I don't think, is because for large periods after this conflict and well after the Second World War, there was official policy of denial that these weapons were used in Abyssinia, or at least there was suggestion that it was only used in a very isolated number of cases. So why don't you talk a little bit about how this was dealt with in Italy after the war and the extent to which chemical weapon use was denied?
Well, it was officially denied for decades after Angelo Del Bocca had a huge... He's the doyen of Italian colonial warfare, writing about Italian colonial warfare. He had a huge, huge difficulty getting any information whatsoever. And I do cover this in the book quite closely. It wasn't Silvio Berlusconi. It was one of his successors, a technocratic prime minister. Under him, the Ministry of Defence first admitted that they had been used and then started to allow access to the documents. And the general staff history by Longo, which I quote extensively from, all it covers the entire campaign and not just chemical warfare. He published a 1,000-page volume of original documents, which I drew on heavily. And that was the first time that one of the first times that the admission of the use of chemical warfare was made. It was denied completely by the Italian government for decades. I mean, in foreign press, in foreign written articles, it was fully explained that mustards had been used, but there was no detail, of course, because the papers, the documents, were in Italian archives and were not available to foreign scholars or even Italian scholars. Only in the last 30 years, 40 years, has that rule been relaxed.
What I thought was interesting, and this, I guess, has parallels today with kind of culture war type perspectives on information and remembering, but it was the idea that the chemical warfare issue almost became a central flashpoint. So it was this idea of, you know, the arguments about whether chemical weapons used suddenly came embroiled with broader debates between the right and the left in Italy. Is that right?
Yes, that's absolutely the case. Yeah, it was considered unpatriotic to question the Italian colonial, the era of Italian colonialism. Those who did so were on the side of the Ethiopians, were communist Marxists, unpatriotic, and were spitting on the memory of the veterans. Familiar arguments from all kinds of contexts. But yeah, that was the case. And of course, when they did eventually release the documentation or allow access to the archive, it cleared up a lot of mysteries, if you like. For example, I always read about that the Italians had sprayed mustard gas from aircraft, which was commonly believed, not in Italy, of course, commonly believed elsewhere. And also, there were accounts. There are very few accounts from the Ethiopian side, mainly perhaps because obviously the country was conquered, and also because the literacy rates were very, very low. But the foreign The foreigners who were on the Ethiopian side, as it were, left accounts of barrels of mustard being dropped from aircraft. And I always wonder, why would you drop a barrel of mustard from an aircraft? Especially when it was being sprayed. But of course, what was happening was these C-500T bombs weren't going off. Perhaps there were misfires, so they were dropping and hitting the ground, and all that would remain was what looked like a barrel of mustard. But this was all, of course, hidden until the archives were opened up in Rome.
And it's fascinating. So actually, I've just looked into this. Now, I may have purveyed a falsehood unwittingly in some of my previous work. I've just realised this because in the one history that covers this at the moment, a lot of the description of the chemical weapon use comes from Selassie. I think they also probably use some smaller shell types as well. But the sprayers seems to have been a myth that has somehow made its way into the history. Is that right?
One of these bombs were designed to explode at altitude. I forget the exact figures, but they worked out that it exploded at a certain altitude. It would give you a kill zone or a contamination zone of such and such a size on the ground. Now, if these things were going off at 600 metres up in the air, a spray of mustard gas would descend. The accounts were on the ground, literally, of barrels of mustard gas being dropped, and also mustard gas being sprayed from the air, square up completely when you understand that they were using this C-500T bomb.
So I think the lovely thing about this book coming out is that people like myself and others, as you say, many of the primary sources you've worked with are Italian. And of course, they just haven't made their way across into the Western sources. So it can be quite a laborious task. And so I think many people, you know, after this show will go away and get hold of a copy of your book, because I think certainly some of the data points you bring out there and some of the discussion really does help update what the kind of conventional understanding of the character and scale of this use was in that conflict. You can find Charles's book on all the regular places, but I, of course, will also add a link into the show notes. And I suggest, if this is an area of your interest, to have a look at this stuff. So thanks very much, Charles. I'll no doubt speak to you again very soon.